people in mental health, they're not all trained on eating disorders. So it's really important to find a therapist who is trained on eating disorders, a psychiatrist who is trained on eating disorders, a nutritionist who is trained with eating disorders.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Conversations with Intent. I'm really excited to be joined by Priya James today, who is the Associate Director of Community Engagement at NEDA, the National Eating Disorders Association. Thanks so much for joining us today, Priya.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
I'm going to jump right into a hard question, which is, how do you think about it when families come to you and they say, I'm concerned about a loved one? How do you decide or how do you think about helping families figure out how serious of an issue they may have and what next steps are depending on what the circumstances are?
Yeah, I think it's really important for the family member or the friend or whoever to really kind of pay attention to that person, see if there's any kind of behaviors of withdrawal, if they usually have family meals, if they're trying to avoid family meals or any kind of social situations. There's a lot going on in this world, so it could always be confused with some sort of like healthy type eating, but it's always best to be safe than sorry. So just kind of pay attention to how they've been acting and behaving, see if there's any kind of concern, and then just sit down with them and kind of have a talk with them and be supportive of them.
And what do you do if you're in a role that's not a parental role? If you're a teacher or a mentor, I feel like it gets tricky around issues related to, hey, I noticed you're not eating, or I noticed, you look like you've lost weight. Back 15 years ago, I come from a family that, lovely family, we're very lucky, but weight loss was a big focus for, especially on one side of my family. So it was very complimentary to tell someone you look like you lost weight. And I've only realized in the last maybe 5 years, I would say, that it's a dicey topic to go down with people you don't know well, because you don't know the history. You don't know if someone had a medical issue. You don't know if they struggled with an eating disorder. And some people don't necessarily want people commenting on their body. So I'm curious how you approach this if you're in a non-parental role. Is it just to tell parents? Is there another type of intervention that you recommend?
I think if it's like a teacher or a coach, they're often the frontline people who see the kids, if it's students, the most. So I paying attention to kind of withdrawal, depression, if they're wanting to skip out on lunch. I started my eating disorder when I was starting high school. I think one of the teachers did notice some changes and referred me to the school counselor. And that was great because I didn't feel like I was getting attacked. I don't remember how she kind of managed to be like, oh, maybe you should try talking to your counselor. But, talking to, if there's like a school mental health person there, talking to them and seeing what the best steps are, and then possibly going, if it's something that's serious, I would get the school counselor involved and get the parents involved, but maybe talking it over with a mental health professional at their school or a school nurse even would be helpful. And then going to the parents and talking to them is often helpful, because there's oftentimes parents don't know how to handle it and deal with it. So if there's a third person there to kind of make the situation more comfortable, I think that would be very helpful and make the person feel more comfortable.
And are you comfortable sharing a little bit about your story with your eating disorder?
Yes, of course. So I started struggling, I'd say probably like starting high school. I was just, I grew up from pre-K to through middle school. I was at a predominantly Caucasian Catholic school. And so I felt different and I didn't know how to control that. So I started having bad behaviors and, it just started getting worse as I went to high school and had like failed relationships. The feeling of not feeling perfect and not feeling enough, got to me. And so then I eventually got help, but that was back then when there wasn't really any eating disorder centers, and eating disorders were definitely not talked about a lot then. So I started seeing a therapist who wasn't really trained in eating disorders, but I was sitting in the office, and this is kind of how I found Anita also. There was this catalog called Gerst Books Catalogs, and it had a lot of mental health and eating disorder books in it. And in the back, it had the website and number to the National Eating Disorders Association. So I went home and I dialed up to the internet, and, you know, I wouldn't say like I found like a ton of resources back then. But the fact that I knew there was an organization that existed, I wasn't going crazy, and there was other people out there that were suffering, really struck me and helped me feel like I wasn't alone. So then I took the steps, you know, I had some cousins, talked to my parents, and I went into an intensive outpatient program and got the help there. But again, that was for depression, because there wasn't any eating disorder specific programs there. So I just kind of self-helped myself back then. And, you know, there are times when I still struggle, and I've had relapses in the past, but I always pick myself up, and it's a hard journey. It goes, recovery is up and down. So I found a lot of peace with working with the National Eating Disorders Association. I started volunteering with them at first. I put on the Houston Needle Walk for 10 years, and then I joined staff a few years ago. And it brings me joy to help other people who are struggling. So
Priya, how did you get involved with NIDA?
NIDA was a very big part of my recovery journey, because I found them when I began struggling. And I touched upon this earlier, but, you know, I found their website back then when there was not really anybody talking about eating disorders. There weren't any treatment centers. So I stumbled upon their website, went home, dialed up, and I felt like I found a community of people that understood. I didn't feel like I was alone. I didn't feel like I was crazy in any kind of way, and that this wasn't really happening to me. I realized, okay, there's other people out there that have this problem, and I'm not alone. And there's this whole organization here that is meant to help people. So I started volunteering with them. I ran the Houston NIDA Walk for 10 years, still doing it. We'll have our next one in November. And I joined staff about 3 years ago. And I'm, you know, this is my life mission and goal, to help other people that have struggled. So
one of the things that strikes me about eating disorders as our company has gotten more involved in that area is that, you know, with substances, you can largely avoid, as they say in AA, people, places, and things that involve alcohol or drugs. And you can't do it completely, but there's a way you can minimize exposure to high-risk situations. But you can't, I think about it with eating disorders and sexually compulsive behaviors, you can't not have a relationship with food, and you can't not have sex forever. I suppose you can, but most people, that's not something they're willing to do. So it becomes about sort of how you reorient yourself, I would imagine, around your relationship with food. I guess I have a couple questions around that. You know, what was that process like for you? And then I'm particularly interested in what was helpful to you that people did and what was not helpful, because I think a lot of times, even with best of intentions, we get things wrong. And I think it's important for parents and other peers to hear kind of, if you're going to intervene or you have a suspicion, what can you say that might make an impact, and what can you say that actually might go the other direction?
I think believing them and knowing that this is an actual real problem that they're struggling with, not like it's just, you know, a simple diet or, you know, they're trying to look pretty. It's just an internal struggle that they are. It's a real mental health disorder, and it's a struggle for them. So just letting them know that you understand them and you're there to support them, not making comments when they're eating something. That was very hard for me. You know, I have publicly shared my story for years now, and there's still people who make comments on like my plate of food or how much I'm eating, not making any kind of appearance comments. Like, there's no need to let them know, oh, you're looking healthy, because they can take that in the completely opposite way of what you're saying. So I, you know, avoiding any, and this is just in general, people should just avoid commenting on people's bodies and looks, you know, in general. So
I'm with you.
Yeah. Think of something else to compliment them about, you know, and, you know, just really being supportive during mealtimes. That's very helpful. It's especially hard these days when people are talking about, I'm on this diet and, you know, I can't eat this, or I ate this earlier today, so I can't eat this. It's hard. I still struggle with that all the time. There's people I know and love who know I have struggled with this for a long time that still do it around me, but it's just natural for them because that's just how our society is.
Sure.
So just trying to kind of like tune that out. And this is like when, like, have been in strong recovery for a while, but so, you know, really trying to make an effort if it's someone who's just, you know, in a recent treatment, just to avoid comments like that, it's really important.
I can see for somebody who is more vulnerable and who may already be on the fence about, like, is this safe to eat? What is this going to do to me? And, you know, do I really want to be eating this, or I'm trying to follow what my nutritionist recommended? And then on top of it, someone's making a comment, how challenging that would be to be able to have freedom. Because the flip side of this is, you know, in an ideal world, people learn to love food, not, you know, see it certainly as a source of energy, which it is. And, you know, the 80-20 rule, putting things that are good in your body, but there's some real joy, at least for me, in food. And so I think a lot about, you know, I've got two daughters, and I think all the time about how do I model behaviors that are going to teach them to try a lot of things, to not be afraid, and to not get overly obsessive, which I had moments in my life that I definitely was.
So important. You know, I have a daughter, and I try to model safe behaviors. There are kids that I know that are starting look like mirror checking and trying to look at calories and stuff at a much, much younger age. And that's really scary. And a lot of it comes from what they see at home, because there's so many like healthy, clean diets now. Kids are seeing their parents do that. Kids are seeing their parents mirror check or make comments about the way they look every single day or how much they exercise every single day. But they hear their parents saying, that's really bad for you, don't eat that, or there's too much sugar in that, or, you know, just it's really important to really try not to. And it's natural for so many people, and it, you know, and I understand that, but kids listen and hear everything, and then they take that back to school, and, you know, it just becomes this domino effect, and, you know, and it really affects children. So, you know, I would really love for parents to really try not to do that anymore. It's a hard, but they're listening to you, and they will start doing and mimicking everything that you do.
No, it's a great point. And that was one of my questions, which is, you know, when you're dealing with a family where you have a predisposition, you're dealing with a mom and potentially a sibling who've had challenges with, you know, their relationships with food. And again, I'm putting gender stereotypes out there, but that's sort of the folks that have come into our practice will sometimes see. A classic example would be a daughter at some type of performing arts school and a mom who has had either a current eating disorder or one in the past. You know, how do you make progress as a clinician, as a teacher in those circumstances where there's a bit more of an embedded culture and or belief system around food from the person that's likely influencing that child, you know, a good portion of the time?
Yeah, I would say some sort of family-based therapy to kind of get the mom or the dad help also, and so they can create a safe environment for everybody in that house, you know. And I say dads too, and I know we were, you know, like you said, we were talking about moms and daughters, but there's a lot, you know, there's a lot of sports that involve weight checking and muscle building, and I'm seeing a lot of young boys being affected by that as well. And it's harder. Usually, you know, statistics say it's harder for the men to, you know, be open about mental health struggles and eating disorders. So it's, if they have a supportive family at home and they don't see those behaviors, it's a lot easier for them to come forward.
Yeah. When you think about effective treatment modalities, you know, what have you seen that has been effective in treating eating disorders? And one of the, yeah, sorry, so go ahead first.
I'm a non-clinician.
Sure.
No, and it's understandable, but I do have a husband that's a psychiatrist, but who specializes in the eating disorders. But, you know, a good, strong team of people who understand eating disorders, because you need to realize people in mental health, they're not all trained on eating disorders. So it's really important to find a therapist who is trained on eating disorders, a psychiatrist who is trained on eating disorders, a nutritionist who is trained with eating disorders. Because oftentimes people go to nutritionists and it's the opposite. It's for the opposite
reason. Absolutely.
And so that can be very triggering. So it's really important to know, like, that your team is very knowledgeable about eating disorders, because that creates a safe team and understanding team, and they can really help you through everything and help your family and your friends with how to deal with the situation.
One of the concerns we've heard from parents, you know, whether this is a projected fear or an actual, you know, there's truth behind it, is the concern that if a child, especially a young child, goes into treatment for eating disorders, they're going to learn sort of more, for lack of a word, tricks of the trade from other other clients who are more advanced in their eating disorder behaviors, or they're going to be influenced negatively by their peer group, is maybe the easiest way to say it. What are your thoughts on that?
I think, honestly, that can happen anywhere. And there's more of a chance for them to get triggered outside of a treatment center with other people. So I think the safest place is in group environments, because everybody understands each other and everybody knows what each other is going through. And I can tell you, a lot of the treatment centers, they pay attention to this kind of stuff. And if they need to, they will separate kids, and they will separate people. So they're very knowledgeable about things like that happening. So they keep their eye out for that, and they do the measures that they need to stop that from happening.
Make sure it doesn't happen. What do you think about community-based interventions, whether it's post-treatment or in lieu of treatment? You know, what have you seen that you think is either groundbreaking or has been around for a long time but has shown some success?
I think it's very important, especially for when people get out of treatment, for patients to find their community. It's hard to go back into the real world. There's so much going on. So if you can find a good support network that really understands you, that makes all the difference. Because not everybody can understand what you've gone through. And it doesn't necessarily have to be someone that has had an eating disorder. It's just somebody who just understands and supports them and doesn't judge them. Nita has had Nita walks in the past for several years. We've changed that into Nita Care Fairs to be more inclusive of all mental health illnesses, because there's so many co-occurring disorders now. So going to events like that, going to groups, it's really important, because you have that safe net that you feel like you could be open with and be honest with, and they get you and you could trust them.
And do you see that through, like, community engagement and these types of walks? Where do you see the role of, I'm thinking of, like, self-help group, the way AA is? I know there's some equivalents on the eating disorder side. Do you see interest in high levels of participation in those types of venues? Is it more clinically oriented, or is it all of the above?
It should be a combination of both, because people who struggle need both, the clinical side and, you know, the event side. So they could come to things like our care fairs and feel like there's other people out there that are struggling and that are supportive. They can come and hear other people's inspirational stories and feel like, okay, it gives you hope, and to hear other people's stories and to see other people, different types of people who struggle with eating disorders. And that helps, because one of the main things with eating disorders is that you feel very lonely, and you go to these events and you go to these groups and you realize you're not alone, and you really do have other people out there to support you.
And when you think about the role of media, which I know I referenced in the beginning, I always wonder if I'm just putting too much blame. It's always easy to blame the media for everything.
Yeah.
But I do think about it as, you know, when I was growing up, and again, sort of best laid plans gone awry. I was a subscriber to Cosmopolitan and Shake Magazine and Self. And those last two I thought were, this is like motivation. I'm not so sure that actually was the case. I think it was aspirational, but for the wrong reasons. You know, now if I'm making changes around my diet or exercise, it's for health related reasons as I age. And for goals like being here for as long as I can with my daughters or picking my daughter up without having a backache, as opposed to I just really want to look like, you know, whoever it was on the cover of the issue. But I guess my question is, do you see a role that they can, that advertisers can continue to play? I know there's been a lot more, you know, use of people of all different sizes, all different backgrounds for modeling. Has that made an impact? Are there other things that we should be doing as a society to combat, you know, to combat the disease?
I definitely think with media, like you said, it's getting a lot better than the 90s and stuff. But showing people of all different sizes, all different ethnicities is so important because people need to see themselves out there. They need to see that clothes are made for everyone. You know, I used to work in the fashion industry, so I saw this a lot, and it was a while ago when people were, you know, when there were stores that had certain looking types of people, and you know, you would look at that and you would be like, I don't look like them. I need to somehow look like them. I can't change the color of my skin. I guess you can change the color of your hair, but like, you know, there's only, and they feel like they can't control certain things, so they get into, you know, bad behaviors, but not bad behaviors, but not good behaviors. I don't know how to say that the best way, but like, it's just, it's really important for people to see themselves out there. And it's getting better. It's slow, but it's definitely getting better. There's lots of brands out there that are not photoshopping people. That was one thing that I had to do when I worked in the industry, like photoshop people, like, to the point where they really did not look like how they actually looked. And then people who are reading magazines and stuff see that and they think it's real and it affects them. So just really showcasing a variety of people is really important.
And how would you suggest that people effectively intervene if they know a loved one has an eating disorder without making them defensive, without enabling them to continue the behaviors? Like what would you suggest is the best approach?
I think it's very important that when you're talking to someone that you feel like may be struggling, you sit down and be very non-confrontational with them. They coming to them and kind of being in attackive mode or accusing mode is just, it won't help the situation anymore. They need to know that you're there to support them. So really sitting down with them and being supportive, letting them know that no matter what, you're with them the entire time. Don't bring up any specific behaviors, just kind of make it feel like you're concerned. And then from there, I think we have a great screening tool on our website and it comes in Spanish now too. So it's a very brief questionnaire. And if you feel like someone is struggling, you can take that brief questionnaire and then go from there and you kind of get an idea if, okay, maybe this is something I really need help with.
What gives you hope?
What gives me hope? Mental health is being talked about more. It's still very stigmatized, but people are talking more openly about it and people are willing to share their stories. And it makes me happy because that's why I do what I do. And I'm so open with my story because when people see or hear stories from other people that they can relate with, it helps them. I know there's, what gives me hope, I guess, is there's still a lot of good people out there who want to help other people. And I think when people are struggling, if they can find those people, that it makes all the difference in the world in their recovery journey.
I totally agree. And it's a great note for us to end on. Thank you, Priya, so much for being vulnerable and sharing your story and your thoughts on how we can continue to combat this disorder and get to a better overall outcome, even for people who don't have diagnosed eating disorders, but struggle with body image and eating issues. Thank you, everyone, for listening and viewing today's podcast episode. We hope that you'll like us on your podcast platform of choice. We're on all of them. We also want you to check out the National Eating Disorders Organization's website. So Priya, give us that website link, please.
Yes, it is www.nationaleatingdisorders.org. That's disorders with an S.
Excellent. You can also reach out to us on this channel, or you can email us at conversations@intentclinical.com. And we hope to see you on the next episode.